From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. In just a few moments, we'll hear from the chief scientist of the Government Accountability Office. He'll be talking about new frontiers in technology and manufacturing. But before we head into the future, let's first take a step back into our distant past. The town of Gray, Tennessee, is about 90 minutes away from Knoxville by car, but going there can actually take you more than 4 million years back in time. Just off the side of State Route 75 is a brick building housing some of the greatest treasures of Tennessee's geologic history. It's the Gray Fossil Site. Paleontologist and museum director Blaine Schubert says working here is a digger's dream.
The Gray Fossil Site is totally unique for the entire Appalachian region. So from Georgia, Alabama, all the way up to Maine, this Appalachian region doesn't have any fossil sites that date anywhere close to the time frame that we're talking about 4.5 to 7 million years old.
There's a reason for that. Fossils are found in sedimentary rocks, the kind made by sand, silt, and other materials that are typically deposited in big bodies of water. But during the Miocene epoch, when the Gray Fossil Site formed, most of eastern North America was dry land. If you and I had been standing here during the Miocene, the landscape would have looked very different.
Looking around, you would have seen saber-toothed cats. Lots and lots of these animals called tapirs, which are closely related to rhinos and horses, but actually look more like a pig with a little bit of a trunk. So a whole menagerie of animals that we don't see here today, shovel-tusked elephants, ground sloths. You know, it's hard to imagine sort of this accumulation of animals here.
The fossils were preserved in a dark gray, nearly watertight clay that built up inside of a sinkhole. There are so many fossils on the 5-acre site that paleontologists like Dave Moscato will have job security for decades, or maybe much longer.
The number has changed over the years, and it's still unsure. Not too long ago, one of our geology professors at ETSU, Dr. Whitelaw, actually calculated it. At the rate we dig every summer, if we continue to dig that same rate every year until we have all the sediment out of the site, how long will it take us? And he came up with a number that was something like 16,000 years.
The fossils found at the Gray Site have made East Tennessee a special place for paleontologists around the world. Blaine Schubert says the bones and fragments uncovered here help us understand the world of the past, but also give us insight into the present and the future.
It's sort of this reality aspect of change through time. As climate changes, environment changes. And as we move forward in a time of climate change, these are the kinds of things we need to think about. And we can look into the past to see how organisms were affected as these global changes occurred.
Because the Miocene was so recent in the wide scope of geologic time, paleontologists can use the fossils from Gray to track evolutionary changes in the descendants of those creatures who are still around today. Gray is also the kind of place that can spread Dave Moscato's infectious enthusiasm to a new generation of fossil hunters, the boys and girls of today who will be making the discoveries of tomorrow.
I don't know a kid who doesn't like dinosaurs and fossils and things. When you have a kid who's excited about that, it's easy to relate to that child, because really what a paleontologist is an adult who never stopped liking those stuff.
And if it's true that it will take more than 16,000 years to dig all the way through the clay deposits, you can bet there'll be plenty for those children to do when they grow up. And now a look at the technology that's transforming the nation's manufacturing sector. WUOT's Chrissy Kuiper spoke recently with Timothy Persons, chief scientist of the Government Accountability Office. He talked about the National Nanotechnology Initiative.
The United States is in the middle of what some would call a manufacturing renaissance, of making things and doing things. And in the meantime, we had invested between 2001 and 2014, now this fiscal year, $20 billion approximately in basic research and development funding on this program called the National Nanotechnology Initiative, or the NNI. those sort of advances and innovations are now proliferating into the marketplace. And the question is, well, are they proliferating in a way that's responsible in terms of environment, safety, and health issues, which have been a concern about nanotechnology? Nano is just a scale term, meaning it's just a size. It means the 1/1,000,000th of a meter. It's 1/1,000th of the width of a hair. And so those things, when they are that small, they behave differently. Even materials that we would be familiar with, like aluminum, which we drink out of in cans and things like that. But at the nanoscale, it has a different behavior, and we want to make sure we understand toxicity and effects and things like that in that environmental and human health, worker safety, and public safety sense. But there's also opportunities. Nanotechnology has tremendous impact or promise on various things ranging from advanced concrete materials to the smartphones that we hold in our palm today and making them smarter and more powerful and so on. So there's a very broad array of things that this touches, and so its implications on the environment, society, the economy, and so on are important, and that's why we did the study.
Can you give us a couple of examples of ways that nanotechnology can be used?
I mentioned the well-established nanotechnology dimension of just the semiconducting domain. So anytime you're using a computer or a smartphone or something like that, then you're using nanotechnology. It just you perhaps haven't thought of it in that domain. So that's well-established and well-known. Mm-hmm. Where you see it coming more and more is into materials. So it's being embedded in things to make them lighter or stronger and those sorts of issues. You have a particular type of nanoparticle is called carbon nanotube, very common, and they're used in producing tennis rackets, something you want to make lighter and you want to make stronger and you want to have higher performance. Advanced clothing, things that have been looked at and are continuing to be looked at by the regulatory agencies in the federal government for environment, health, and safety issues.
What is your scientific background?
I did my work in physics and nuclear physics, and then I also did some graduate work in computer science, and then my dissertation was in biomedical engineering.
Does it help or hinder you to be a scientist? Do you feel like your job is political?
No, the good news is that GAO as an agency is indeed very nonpartisan and non-ideological, fact-based type entity. And we're quite proud of that. We work and endeavor all the time to focus on quality work that's nonpartisan. It's not a difficult job in terms of being a scientist in that regard. The challenge is often how to communicate complex scientific issues in accessible ways so that they're understandable, that the implications can be seen without diminishing the science or oversimplifying the essence of where we are, what some issue is.
That does it for this edition of The Method. You can listen to any of our past installments at our website, wuot.org. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.